From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Today is Tuesday, April 19th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. Britain is sending troops to Libya. They're only going in as advisors, but today's announcement provokes concern even among the government's own supporters.
This mission creep into regime change is making, I think, a number of us nervous.
Also, Libya's rebel PR machine.
Some picked up the gun and some picked up the microphone.
And Peru's national anthem is all about slavery, whimpering, and defeat. Some Peruvians say it's about time for a more cheerful national song.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. The British government is sending a team of military officers to assist rebel forces in eastern Libya. The officers will join an existing diplomatic team in the rebel stronghold of Benghazi. British officials say it's a limited mission aimed at helping the rebels with military organization and not with military training. But the move is drawing questions and criticism. The World's Laura Lynch reports from London.
It was just a month ago that the United Nations approved the resolutions authorizing member states to take all necessary measures to protect civilians in Libya. But they explicitly ruled out foreign military actions on the ground. So today, Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague chose his words carefully in announcing the deployment of military officers to work on Libyan soil.
Our purpose is to help save civilian lives, which of course is the purpose of the United Nations resolutions. And they will do that by helping the Libyan opposition with their organizational structures, with things like communications and logistics, how to coordinate humanitarian aid and medical supplies. They're not there, I stress, to train fighting forces, to arm fighting forces, or of course to take part in any fighting themselves.
Hague's reassurances aren't enough for some here. Conservative Member of Parliament John Barron has seen Britain offer the rebels body armour, communications equipment, and now this.
What seems to have happened over these last 10 days is that we're creeping this mission creep into regime change is making, I think, a number of us nervous.
Colonel Richard Kemp used to advise governments on military operations. He says those who worry may well have reason, based on what's happened in other conflicts.
I think you have to be prepared to go where the battle leads you to an extent. Obviously, you have to have maybe certain limitations, certain red lines in your mind, and sometimes they have to be changed. But history shows us you can't enter a combat zone in any capacity and know exactly what's going to happen next.
Kemp goes further, suggesting that protecting civilians may require foreign forces to enter Libya.
If you go to the extreme step of bombing another country, as we have, that's a very major decision. And if your objectives are worth doing that, then I think your objectives may be worth going further and putting people on the ground if that's going to have an effect of multiplying the combat capability of the rebels.
The government isn't ready to go that far, but William Hague was careful not to rule out arming the rebels in the future.
We cannot foresee every situation that would arise. Our interpretation of the resolutions is that in certain restricted circumstances, it's legally permissible to give people the ability to defend themselves, but that's not what we're doing.
In Tripoli, Libya's Deputy Foreign Minister Khalid Kaim was once again warning foreign troops to stay away, even if they come to protect humanitarian workers.
If there is any deployment of any armed personnel on the Libyan ground, and we will have access, there will be a fighting, and the Libyan government will not take it as a humanitarian mission.
The announcement in London comes just as the rebel forces plead for more foreign firepower to target Gaddafi forces in the besieged city of Misrata. Britain is increasingly ready to take the side of the rebels in the name of protecting civilians, but there's little sign the UN-backed coalition will back any plan to send troops into Libya. For The World, I'm Laura Lynch in London.
Muammar Gaddafi's government has granted safe passage for United Nations teams, but the government has not guaranteed it's going to stop fighting. It's not clear what this means for international efforts to help the people in Misrata. Valerie Amos is the UN's humanitarian chief. She's just returned from Libya. Ms. Amos, could you clarify this for us? You met with Colonel Gaddafi's prime minister and the foreign minister. You were given assurances that UN humanitarian workers could come and go freely to Tripoli. The fighting, though, is still raging in Misrata. So do you believe them that when they say that the humanitarian workers will be able to have access and egress safely?
I was looking for two main things. The principal thing I wanted, of course, was a cessation of hostilities so that people who are frightened and who are in a very volatile and insecure environment could get out and that we could get supplies in. I got no clear agreement on that. I was also looking for agreement to establish a humanitarian presence in Tripoli that we could then use as the basis for moving around, particularly the west of the country, to get a clear and independent view of what is going on. I specifically raised Misrata and asked the government for guarantees that would enable humanitarian workers to get to Misrata by road. What I hope people understand is that this is a contested city, so part of it is controlled by the opposition and part of it is controlled by the government. So we need the government to help us to get in by road. We can get in by sea because the ports are controlled by the opposition. The government agreed that they would give us the guarantees to enable us to get in by road. We will have to test this, of course, and we're putting our plans in place now to try and get in as quickly as possible.
Because you're saying even with the government guarantee, if there is no ceasefire, then your people aren't necessarily safe.
Of course not, and we have a duty of care to our people. This is an intense conflict situation. We've all been horrified, I think, by some of the pictures that we have seen on our television screens. We've heard reports of the use of cluster munitions, which are banned, and you will know that particularly what they leave are things that look like toys, which little children pick up, and they're very, very dangerous.
Will these humanitarian aid workers be armed?
No, they will not be armed. It's very important for our humanitarian work that we are seen as independent, impartial, neutral. We're seen as not taking sides. We cannot be armed.
Will they be safe among not just those fighting on behalf of the government, but also rebels or even NATO forces, because there have been lethal mistakes that have been made already?
I was in Benghazi as well as Tripoli to get those assurances from the opposition. And of course, if we have people moving around the country, we will make sure that we inform NATO forces.
Do you have any hope of being able to garner a ceasefire so this can be done with more safety and assurance?
We have to keep trying. I mean, it's people that are suffering at the end of this. It's families, it's women, it's children, it's men. We have to keep trying to get a ceasefire. That is at the top of my agenda.
All right. Valerie Amos, UN humanitarian chief, talking to us about humanitarian efforts being made now in Libya. She has just returned from Tripoli. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Libyan rebels are looking for all the help they can get to handle Muammar Gaddafi's army, but they could also use some help in their media campaign. The rebels' public relations efforts have highlighted the humanitarian crisis in Misrata. Since the beginning of the uprising in Libya, rebels have used Facebook, Twitter, and a network of Western-educated English speakers to reach out to the international media. As the World's Ben Gilbert reports, that's helped promote their cause, but it hasn't been easy.
When the foreign press first entered eastern Libya in late February, they were greeted as liberators. In Benghazi, a massive crowd of demonstrators chanted CNN, CNN, as the first Western television crew filmed from the top of a nearby building. Now, nearly 2 months later, the same burned-out building houses the rebels' press center. Here, journalists can find free internet access, pamphlets outlining the rebel government structure, and helpful volunteers.
Hey guys.
Isha F. Taita is one of the rebels' volunteer press coordinators. Raised in Canada, the 23-year-old returned to Libya last year to teach English in Benghazi. Now she's one of the first people that thousands of foreign journalists meet when they arrive in the de facto rebel capital.
We release the press passes. We register whoever comes in because
Officially, you guys aren't in Libya because you guys have no stamp. Just to be sure, with safety and security procedures, we try to get translators and drivers together with the actual press.
Many of those drivers and translators are also volunteers, but a journalist has to be careful. The volunteers are nearly all pro-revolution, making objective coverage difficult. But this is not Gaddafi's Tripoli, and journalists are free to explore on their own, sometimes to the rebels' detriment. F. Taita says the goal is to show journalists that the rebel government, the Revolutionary Transitional National Council, is actually in charge of what's happening in eastern Libya and on the front lines.
What we're trying to do with the media is to show that the council is connected to even the lowest ranks of whatever we're doing right now, more or less.
It's not easy. As the rebel media campaign has sought to cater to the press, it's also found itself on a steep learning curve. On a field trip to visit captured Gaddafi forces in Benghazi, the rebel media minders received a call from an agitated Human Rights Watch staffer named Peter Bocart. He told the rebels they were in violation of the Geneva Conventions by marching prisoners of war before the press. When the minders tried to shut the tour down, they then drew the ire of dozens of angry journalists.
Who is Peter? Does he have an authority over the Transitional Council?
No, he does not.
Of course.
But we respect the human rights. We are not like Gaddafi, okay?
Eventually, the journalists won and were brought into the prison to see the prisoners. But the event was anything but informative, as a gaggle of journalists wielding TV cameras and microphones surrounded a dozen weary men. Rebels in camouflage fatigues also launched questions at the prisoners. The rebels' pressmen, in suit jackets, translated for a captured brigadier general named Mohammed Aladdin Hamesh.
I asked him, and he concluded the question as well, how is the treatment? Is this against your will to give any information to the media? He said, no, I am willing to give the information, and it's not against my will, and the treatment is perfect. I have not been treated bad. And this guy even said, are you just saying this in front of the media? He said, no, I'm saying this because of my saying.
Mustafa Gariani hopes to avoid embarrassing episodes like this in the future. He says most of the rebels' PR footwork is done by him, a teacher at a dental school, and an agricultural engineer.
We found ourselves in this position because of need more than anything else. And in Libya, in this revolution, everybody volunteered with whatever they can. Some picked up the gun and some picked up the microphone. And we found ourselves into the press. We didn't really know much about it. We're still learning.
Gariani is a U.S. citizen and calls Fenton, Michigan, home. He happened to be on a visit back to Libya in February when the revolution erupted. His only experience with media before this was during a run for the local school board.
And I lost. Right,
you lost, you lost the campaign?
Of course. But I think it was fun. It's you experience democracy at its best when you try to do something like that. And we hope we'll have the same in this country.
Not a bad effort at linking American democracy and the Libyan rebel cause. The rebels have also used Twitter, Facebook, and other social media to lobby both the media and Western governments. And they've gotten a little outside help. The Transitional Council has hired at least one Western public relations consultant to come to Benghazi in the hopes he can help them hone their message. For The World, I'm Ben Gilbert.
You can explore more of our coverage on Libya, including photos from Ben Gilbert, at theworld.org. And while you're there, add your voice to the conversation on Twitter. Once again, that's at theworld.org. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Today, Fidel Castro made his first public appearance in Cuba since he handed over power to his brother Raul 5 years ago. Party leaders gave Fidel a rousing welcome. The two Castros received a long-standing ovation today, followed by a rendition of the Cuban national anthem. This all took place before the Communist Party Congress in Havana. Now, Raul Castro is already president, but today he officially succeeded his brother as head of Cuba's ruling Communist Party. The party also named a new slate of leaders, most of them who are in their 70s and 80s. Andy Gomez is assistant provost and senior fellow of the Cuban Institute at the University of Miami. Professor, we know that Raul Castro and brother Fidel called for fresh faces and new ideas in the top leadership of Cuba. Did they get it?
Well, no, they didn't. And those Cubans that are young, that were told that they are the ones responsible for carrying the revolution forward, should be a little bit disappointed, because what Raul and the Politburo did was keep the old guard in place.
So what's going on? Because we have heard about economic opportunities, some new market forces, including the possible buying and selling of homes by Cubans. Why is that not reflected in the new Communist Party Congress?
Well, because we're beginning to see very clearly that they want to control the political system in itself. What they're opening up is the economic reforms, which they were voted on, all 300 plus, trying to improve the conditions of those Cubans that live on the island. Now, that's going to be tough. Telling Cubans that you can buy property, telling Cubans you can start your own business, where are you going to borrow the money from? Where are you actually, how are people going to pay for those services? I give Raul 6 months to a year to meet the basic needs of the Cuban people. More food, better shelter, better health care, better education. If that doesn't happen within the year, I think you can see social unrest in Cuba.
But what about Fidel? He's 84 years old right now, came in surrounded by bodyguards, dressed in his blue tracksuit, looking better than he has in the past, being greeted by roars of applause. Does he have any more say in the government now?
I think Fidel has a say in the government just for the fact that Raul has been next to him all his life. Fidel will concentrate or will be asked for advice on international issues.
And what does that mean for U.S.-Cuban relations?
Oh, I think U.S.-Cuban relations have come now to the old Cold War at a standstill. The Obama administration is not going to be willing to give them any more concessions. It is up to Cuba to make the next move.
We're speaking to you in Miami. How about especially Miami Cubans who are so active in Cuban-American affairs? Is this going to affect their relationship at all with family members who remain in Cuba?
People outside Miami need to understand that the Cuban-American community in Miami has changed tremendously. We are concerned about Cuba, but it's not on the top priority. And we proved that when we conducted a poll scientifically during the last presidential election. Most Cuban-Americans were concerned about the economy and the war in Iraq than they were on Cuba.
That's Andy Gomez, assistant provost and senior fellow at the Cuban Institute at the University of Miami. As we just heard, officials at the Communist Party Congress in Havana sang a robust version of Cuba's national anthem today. Well, some people in Peru are less enthusiastic about their country's anthem. The first verse is the one that everybody sings along with, and it invokes slavery, humiliation, and horror. As John Otis reports, with Peru riding an economic wave, some believe their country deserves a more upbeat musical tribute.
Largo tiempo el peruano oprimido, la ominosa cadena arrastró.
That's Julio César Rivera, a retired government accountant, singing the opening lines of the Peruvian national anthem.
Largo tiempo.
For a long time, he sings, the oppressed Peruvian dragged the ominous chain. Condemned to cruel servitude, he quietly whimpered. It's supposed to be a patriotic homage to the fatherland, but Rivera describes Peru's national anthem as a colossal bummer.
Las letras del himno nacional de mi país no son nada positivas.
The words are not at all positive, Rivera says, and it's one of the factors that affects our national spirit.
Este es el video Este es el CD.
Rivera spent the last 10 years, as well as thousands of dollars, researching the anthem, penned in 1821. He has self-published two thick books about the song's history. Like many South American anthems, he says, it resembles a mini-opera, long and dramatic, but with a heroic finish. But in public performances, no one sings all seven stanzas. So, Peruvians never get to hear the more inspiring lyrics about rising up and seizing independence from Spain. Rivera wants to scrap the lyrics and replace them with some of his own.
Es con la misma música. Y dice así. Con justicia vivamos en paz, igualdad y libertad.
Rivera has written three new verses, set to the old music, that speak of justice, liberty, and the good things Peru has given to humanity. He's even cut a CD of his new anthem, featuring a classical tenor.
Honremos a padres y héroes, solidarios hicieron la nación.
But Rivera's crusade has met resistance.
Most of the people don't want to change the lyrics of the anthem, you know, because we don't pay so much attention to that.
To Lima analyst José Luis Sardón, the anthem seems appropriate given Peru's often tragic history. It was here where Spanish conquistadors crushed the Incan Empire. Later, in the 19th century War of the Pacific, Peru lost a huge patch of mineral-rich territory to Chile.
In most of the history, Peruvians have been very depressive people. Because we have lost all wars, especially the war with Chile was quite traumatic for us.
Si quieres cambiar el himno de raíz, tendrías que refundir.
Lima columnist Sinesio López says before creating a more upbeat national anthem, Peru itself must change. Amid the economic bonanza, more than a third of Peruvians still survive on $2 or less a day.
Para, al menos lo de abajo no cambia, ¿no?
For poor people, nothing has changed, López says, and that goes against this optimistic outlook. The Peruvian government did tweak the national anthem in 2009. Instead of changing the lyrics, officials decreed that the sunnier sixth verse should be sung in place of the oppressive first verse. Rivera takes me to a Lima high school where students sing the updated anthem on the first day of classes. With its references to the flag and the Andes Mountains, the new lines are more cheerful. But Rivera can't stop lobbying for his own lyrics.
Porque en la música sí,
la música.
Ya, es bien difícil cambiar la
música.
Rivera takes up the issue with the high school music teacher, and before leaving, he presses a CD of his new and improved national anthem into the teacher's hands. For The World, I'm John Otis, Lima.
Spicy food and no cigarettes, those stories still to come on The World on PRI. That's Public Radio International. I'm Lisa Mullen. Still to come, in Sierra Leone, where most people can't read, radio is more than just entertainment.
For example, if the radio is on, it's like life for the people. And when the radio is off, it's like darkness.
Trying to grow an independent radio network in Sierra Leone, coming up.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. International observers describe this weekend's election in Nigeria as one of the country's fairest in decades, but yesterday riots broke out in the north. It happened just after the incumbent president, Goodluck Jonathan, was named the winner. Jonathan is a Christian from the south. Nigeria's south is predominantly Christian. The north is mostly Muslim, and there's an informal agreement to rotate the presidency. Some in the north thought that that agreement had been violated with Jonathan's election, so they went on rampages, destroying churches and homes and businesses. These witnesses who fled say they saw people lose everything in the riots.
They are homeless. I saw people that have been killed.
I saw people running just to save their lives. Houses were burned where I reside.
Inside my home, there's no peace here. People have been running out of that place. I have to run for my own dear life.
The BBC's Dan Isaacs witnessed the elections in the north. He is now in the capital, Abuja.
I was in the northern city of Kano, one of those places where there has now been serious trouble and unrest. And the voting there went extremely well. And for Nigerian elections, and I've been to the past few, this was remarkably well carried out. It was peaceful, it was orderly, the ballot papers and all the voting materials arrived on time. People did queue for a long time in the hot sun to be able to vote, but there was a great optimism that the polling was going very well. What happened after that was that people started to, in the north, the people that had been voting for the opposition candidate, the main opposition candidate, Muhammadu Buhari, when it became evident that he was losing and losing badly to the incumbent president, Goodluck Jonathan, people started to get very upset. They believed there had been rigging, and that there had been rigging not at the polling stations, but afterwards at the counting, at the central counting station in Abuja. And that's what they got very upset about, and that's when the unrest started. And it started with those opposition supporters of Muhammadu Buhari going for the what they known supporters of Goodluck Jonathan, and that largely was Muslim communities going for Christian communities in the very divided cities such as Kaduna in the north of Nigeria.
What are the main issues that people there are concerned about, both in the north and in the south?
Well, there are so many issues facing a president of Nigeria and a government of Nigeria. I mean, just one of them is so well illustrated by what you might be able to hear in the background. It's an enormous generator keeping the power of this hotel going perhaps half the day. A country that produces an enormous amount of oil and gas. It's one of Africa's largest energy producers. It doesn't have the capability to provide power to its people. So that is one of the reasons, and you can hear behind me, the generator has just stopped, the power has come back to the hotel, and this is a constant sound in Abuja and across Nigeria.
One other question. Goodluck Jonathan is seen as good news for Nigeria by many in the international community. Many thought that he would fight the corruption that is so endemic in Nigeria. Does he right now, is he seen to have the support of the international community?
I think by the fact that the election was seen to be carried out in a very straightforward and free and fair way and a transparent way, in a rigorous way, by the Election Commission here for the first time in the last 12 or so years. By that very fact, he has the support of the international community. I think it will be interesting to see whether the complaints by the opposition that there was fraud and rigging at the central level during the accounting of this election, whether that holds any sway. But yes, the international community, if you like, wants a stable Nigeria. They want a democratically elected president they can do business with, and that's somebody that actually holds sway on the international stage as the leader of a country by popular mandate. That is what countries not just further afield but in the region as well, because Nigeria is a very important player in the region. If Nigeria gets it right with its elections, the rest of the region will look to it and try to follow and emulate it.
Dan, thank you. The BBC's Dan Isaacs in Abuja, Nigeria, speaking to us about the post-election violence in Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation. Thanks very much, Dan.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
Sierra Leone is no stranger to violence. The West African nation suffered through years of horrific civil war that officially ended in 2002. That same year, four radio stations pooled their resources to provide independent coverage of Sierra Leone's presidential elections, and that led to the development of the Independent Radio Network. The IRN now has 24 member stations.
You listen to the biggest and hottest radio station Tuesday morning.
The network broadcasts independent news, music, and, of course, soap operas.
You know, in big guys are down that way, like Colonel Kindo and Captain Booba.
That's one of the broadcast soap operas. Ambrose James is the Sierra Leone country director for Search for Common Ground, an organization that helped launch the network known as IRN.
What the Independent Radio Network is trying to do is to push the whole notion of diversity, that there are different viewpoints and that everybody has a voice, and to ensure that all these diverse voices have a space to talk about their own issues.
Is it hard to keep it independent?
Yes, it is very hard to keep it independent, because when the radio stations air programs that do not favor politicians or do not favor rich people, there's pressure, you know, to shut down. There's pressure on them to stop broadcasting. So it's very difficult.
How do you resist that, though? What can you do?
Well, the network provides that space. So when one of the radio stations is being attacked or is being threatened, then the network, 24 radio stations, will come together and say, no, this is our member. You can't do this. There are rules to the game. If you are disturbed by a broadcast, take it to the Independent Media Commission. You can't just shut down a radio station. So that is what the network brings in.
Are there independent journalists there? Has this been an enhancement to what they are allowed to report?
Yes, there's a lot of independence there. You know, before, information was used as a tool for manipulation in Sierra Leone. So the new wave now, with all these little radio stations in different communities, is beginning to challenge local leaders to be more responsive, to be more, you know, accountable. And that shift from the days when they used to use information to manipulate the minds to now, which is about transparency, that is what the network is trying to provide.
Ambrose, what is the importance of radio there in the first place?
Radio is very important to the communities out in Sierra Leone. In a country where the infrastructure is very poor, where there is a lack of electricity, where there is lack of internet, Twitter, Facebook, where a population of about 6 million people, and you have about 20 doctors, people cling on to the radio for information about health, information about HIV and AIDS, and how to prevent that. A lot of the communities depend on agriculture, but can't get information about fertilizers, pesticides to help their crop, information about how their local councils work. So it's very powerful because the infrastructure is not there. So these local radio stations, you know, provide all this sort of information for communities out there.
And how do people in the communities get the information? In other words, how do they access radio? Do they have portable radio? Do they carry radios with them?
Yes, every household in the communities have portable radio sets. They are small ones that people can use headphones on when they ride their bicycles, you know, across the towns. They listen to the radio. In fact, they're dependent on the radio stations themselves. For example, if the radio is on, it's like life for the people. And when the radio is off, it's like darkness. So it's about like sunshine versus darkness. So sometimes the radio goes off because of the generator or a breakdown of some equipment, and people feel really, really sad because they can't get the kind of information that they want. They cling on to these radios, you know, from the time they are on until the time they shut down.
And is there one particular line of programming? I mean, you have various stations with various outputs. Is there one that you think has made a significant impact?
Nearly all of them have made considerable impact in the communities.
How can you tell, though? How do you know?
It's about listenership. It's about feedback. I mean, people text in, and the number of text messages that they receive, they can't even read all of them on air. I mean, there have been issues about where they've unearthed corruption with local councils, and those local council officials have been fired from their job. There have been issues where a number of sick people have been able to find solace by just the broadcast that they provide.
Is there one supremely popular program?
Yes, the radio soap opera that we produce called Atunda Ayenda. It's a local language, which means lost and found. It's very, very popular. It's really like an institution now in that country.
It's a soap opera.
It's a soap opera, and over 95% of the population listen to it every day. If you don't send that program to the radio station, or the radio station does not receive the CD, I mean, there's a lot of phone calls from communities about where's the program, why it's not being aired. So it's something that people love, and it's really, really popular.
Ambrose James, Country Director for Search for Common Ground in Sierra Leone, talking to us about the growth of the Independent Radio Network there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've got photographs of the actors recording that soap opera in a Freetown radio studio at theworld.org. Now, it's hard to grab a smoke in the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan, and it's getting harder. The government banned smoking in public places, and it's against the law to grow or import tobacco. As of January, tobacco smuggling can get you 3 years in prison. Already, two people are serving that sentence, including a Buddhist monk. The government of Bhutan says it's all to protect the health of the population, but many Bhutanese are wondering if this is going a little too far. The World's Mary Kay Magstead reports from the capital, Thimphu.
Anywhere else in the world, a pool hall or snooker parlor would likely be filled with smoke. Not here. This one is filled with Buddhist monks, and it's smoke-free. So by law are all public spaces in Bhutan. The monks here declined to comment on the fate of another monk, who's now serving a 3-year sentence for smuggling in tobacco. But out on the street in Thimphu, 18-year-old Pema Wangchuk laments how hard it's become to find a cigarette.
Sometimes we feel very desperate. So that's sometimes I feel that it's not good by banning such things, cigarette.
Ministry of Health Secretary Garud Serang thinks it's a very good thing to ban cigarettes. He says the new policy will reduce smoking, save lives, and might save the government's ability to offer free health care to all Bhutanese citizens.
So we were telling the people, unless we work together and prevent diseases, which is based on the concept of primary health care, it will not be possible for us to sustain these free health care services because the cost of health care is rising drastically. The technology involved is so high, and demand of people is going high.
What's more, Tsering says, disease patterns in Bhutan are changing as the country modernizes and urbanizes, with more cases of hypertension and heart disease. He says respiratory illnesses, including tuberculosis, are already the leading cause of death in Bhutan, and smoking only makes them worse. Member of Parliament Ugun Wangdi helped shepherd through the legislation that made tobacco smuggling a felony, punishable by 3 years in prison, and he's proud of it. He says the government banned tobacco sales 6 years ago, but then smugglers were doing a roaring business, and too many Bhutanese were still smoking. He says Parliament had to toughen the penalties.
If you keep it whereby you can pay just money and get off, then there is no meaning. So that's why we thought, no, we should not allow somebody to pay a fine. If somebody is caught, they should go behind the bar. So that's why the offense is categorized as fourth-degree felony.
Not all Bhutanese see this as reasonable. Many have protested that the penalty is way too harsh. Nidrup Zangpo is editor of the English language edition of the newspaper The Bhutan Observer.
Tobacco, it is one of the biggest debates since the start of democracy in Bhutan in 2008. People say it's draconian, and we understand why people say that. And Observer has been saying we have to look at the act once again and try to minimize the penalties.
Zangpo is not a smoker, never was. But back in his village, his parents used to use tobacco, and he says some villagers even grew it for private use. That's all gone now. Some local governments in rural areas say smoking has dropped dramatically since the ban on tobacco cultivation and sales started in 2004. They want to keep the current act in place, too. But in the capital, Thimphu, Zangpo says where there's a will to smoke, there's still a way.
And we have to admit that despite strict implementation of the act and heavy penalties, there's still a thriving black market of tobacco. There's a strong network of people working the black market.
There's also the fact that Bhutanese who travel abroad, including just across the land border to India, are allowed to bring in up to 200 cigarettes for their own private use. They just have to pay 100% duty for Indian cigarettes and 200% for cigarettes from anywhere else. At those prices, smoking has become a guilty pleasure of the elite. I saw a couple of them light up in the leafy backyard of an official's home. Still, for all the controversy the 3-year prison sentence for cigarette smuggling has caused, Bhutan Observer editor Zangpo says he likes the ban on public smoking and on sales of tobacco.
Because my children won't have easy access to tobacco products. Well, free of tobacco. We're thinking long term.
Still, the question lingers of whether such a long term in prison for those who smuggle cigarettes is really necessary for the health of the nation. For The World, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Thimphu, Bhutan.
From Bhutan, we now go to Southwest China for our geoquiz today. We're on the lookout for a city known for its silk, tea houses, and traditional spices. We're talking peppercorns, ginger, and chili peppers that pack some heat. But new spices and Western-style dishes are starting to appear around this town. The landscape of the city that lies east of the Chong Lai Mountains is also changing fast.
I mean, the city I lived in 15 years ago has been almost completely demolished and rebuilt. And it's quite confusing coming back here because I hardly know where I am.
We'll clear up any confusion and name this Chinese provincial capital in just about a minute. Here's a heads up, by the way. The GeoQuiz texting game returns tomorrow. Just text the word GeoQuiz to 69866 and we'll text you back with instructions on how to play along. Usual texting rates apply. Again, that's GeoQuiz at 69866. Tomorrow on The World, an alternative to alternative fuel on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. For our GeoQuiz today, we're on the lookout for a Chinese city with a reputation for mouth-numbing spices. Fuchsia Dunlop is a food writer who once studied in the southwestern city of Chengdu, which is the answer to the quiz today. 10 years on, she has returned to the capital of Sichuan province to see what's changed.
Oh, gosh, it's almost impossible to express the scale of the change. You know, when I lived here, most of the city was full of old wooden houses and these narrow lanes where you'd see street vendors and, you know, people offering to polish your shoes or sharpen your kitchen cleavers going around on their bicycles. There were old tea houses on every back street where elderly men would take their songbirds out for the day and people would play cards and mahjong. And anyway, the whole of that old city really has been swept away by the juggernaut of development. Almost all the old lanes have been demolished, and in their place, skyscrapers are sprouting up, as they say in Chinese, like bamboo shoots after rain. So it's quite a weird experience.
So I wonder if the culinary trends have developed as the place has.
The heart of the cuisine is still there. You know, it's bold, spicy cuisine, internationally famous and famous in China for its numbing and hot flavors, the use of lip-tingling Sichuan pepper and chilies in all kinds of different forms to season the food. But really, the soul of Sichuanese cooking lies in its blending of flavors, what they call fuhe wei, complex flavors. So you've got sort of sweet, spicy, sour, salty, lip-tingling, numbing, all these tastes and sensations going on in a single meal. But having said that, yes, it's also in a state of flux. I mean, one of the great things about Sichuanese cuisine has always been that it's so dynamic and warm and welcoming and sort of open-minded, you know, and chefs, ever since I've first been sort of visiting and living here, have been curious about new ingredients and very adaptable and open-minded. But I guess that the last few years, the pace of change has stepped up. So you've got all these restaurants from different parts of China kind of opening branches in Chengdu. You've got new ingredients and dishes. So, for example, on Sichuanese restaurant menus, many of them are now serving dishes made with duo lajiao, chopped salted chilies, which is really a Hunanese pickle, which was virtually unknown here when I lived here. So you've got a blending of other cuisines, you know, from other parts of China, and also lots of foreign influences. You know, you can buy lots of Western ingredients. So it's becoming a more sort of global cuisine. But sometimes I do worry that people are going to lose touch with the very wonderful traditions they have.
So is anybody upholding those traditions then? Even maybe some of the street vendors, they might be displaced, but I wonder if they're still there or if there are small restaurants that continue to serve the traditional cuisine, including the numbing flavors. Kind of an interesting
well, the
term.
Numbing flavors, I think, will go on because they're so exciting. But yes, I mean, some of them are finding new places to trade. For example, you know, I went to a very nice vegetable market yesterday morning, and around the edges of the market, there are stalls where people have fixed places to go on doing their small-scale snack making. So there was a guy making le shan ruo bing, these delicious twirly sort of flat pastries, speciality of le shan, where the giant seated Buddha is in southern Sichuan. And these pastries, they're sort of fried in oil and then baked in a kind of ad hoc oven. And inside you have minced pork and scallion and Sichuan pepper, and they're just gorgeous and exciting.
Why is it that Sichuan food is so fiery?
Oh, well, I mean, according to Chinese theory, it's because the climate here is very damp and muggy. So in Sichuan, with the sort of cold clamminess of winter and the steamy humidity of summer, it's imperative to eat lots of the kinds of foods that drive out that unhealthy dampness and restore equilibrium to the body. And chilies and Sichuan pepper really fit the bill. So that's why they say they have such a fiery diet.
All right, Fuchsia Dunlop in the sizzling hot capital of Sichuan Province. Chengdu, China is where she is right now, which is the answer to our quiz. Thanks so much, Fuchsia.
Thank you.
Now, how about a little music from China to go with a fiery Chinese meal? Here's music critic Tom Schnabel with a suggestion.
I recently got a new album by a Chinese artist named Sa Ding Ding. I think this is her second or third album, but it's probably going to be the one that makes her most popular in countries outside of China. The new album is called Harmony. She teamed up with a guy named Marius De Vries. He's the producer of YouTube, York, and Rufus Wainwright, among others. So she's found a good mix of modern electronica with various Chinese styles, new and old. The first track we're going to hear is Xi Carnival. Xi means happiness in Mandarin, but here it's sung in Sanskrit. The lyrics come from a Buddhist mantra, which basically is a mantra about women in particular to have happiness in this life. The interesting thing about Sa Ding Ding is that she sings in different styles and she sings in different languages, and I think that's why her appeal is much broader. She's also really has her eye on modernity and doing something really, really new. She's gotten herself in trouble for doing Tibetan chants on her records. She's gotten in trouble with the authorities in Beijing, but she continues to do very, very interesting work. The next song on Harmony by Sa Ding Ding that caught my attention is a song called Introspection. It's a half Tibetan sutra and half self-created language. It's a song about finding one's better self. Song that I picked from the new album is a song called Ha Ha Li Li. It's about the harmony of people with nature, both in the more primitive past with people living in caves as well as modern times. It's about being at one with the world and with others. And this song ends the album and features a cool remix by a guy who's a giant in house music and in dance music around the world. His name is Paul Oakenfold.
Love.
The new album by Sa Ding Ding is called Harmony. I'm Tom Schnabel from KCRW in Santa Monica, California.
You can learn more about Sa Ding Ding at theworld.org. I'm Lisa Mullins, coming to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.
PRI, Public Radio International.